You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
There is nothing to accept or to deny. First of all, I repeat, these are preliminary statements. We cannot accept as a final truth what they say. I bet you haven't seen any proofs of that statement.
Russia denies everything, as usual, but how will Vladimir Putin respond in the longer term to a new report into the shooting down of MH17? I'll discuss that with my guests, Oscar Juadiola Rivera and Quentin Peel. Those stories plus, Shimon Peres, good guy, bad guy, neither or both. Israel mourns the passing of a founding father. Colombia's upcoming referendum on the peace agreement ending half a century of civil war, and referenda themselves, unadulterated expressions of the people's will or dangerous populist boondoggles. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow at Chatham House, contributor to the Financial Times, and Oscar Juadiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University here in London. Welcome both. And we shall start with that report by the Dutch-led international investigation into the crash of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 in Ukraine in 2014, with the loss of all 298 passengers and crew. The conclusions are much as might have been anticipated, at least by anybody who doesn't rely heavily on Russia today for their view of the world. That is that the Boeing 777 was shot down by a Russian-supplied Buk surface-to-air missile launched from Ukrainian territory controlled by Russian proxies. Quentin, first of all, is there any reason at all to doubt these conclusions?
No, I don't think so. I think they look to be a very thorough exercise. This is not a spun exercise. I mean, you've had the Dutch, the Belgians, Australians, Malaysians, all very much involved here. This is a broad group trying to get at the truth. They've got video evidence of the missile launcher being brought from Russia into the country and then taken out again. They've got a lot of telephone evidence. So it is pretty, I think, conclusive. Having said that, I don't think Mr. Putin cares.
Oscar, Russia, as we noted in the introduction there, begs to differ. Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, said the investigation is biased and politically motivated. And Leonard Slutsky, the head of the Parliamentary Committee of the Commonwealth of Independent States, says these conclusions seek to achieve only one objective, to further marginalise the image of Russia in the global political and information space. Do we imagine either of those two gentlemen actually believe that, or is this the party line they are expected to wheel out?
I mean, come on, none of us would be surprised by these statements. They are as they would be expected. As the saying goes, truth is the first casualty in war. The problem is that truth is always a casualty in these cases because of the misdeeds of both sides. And that's, of course, a problem. That is not to say that in this case the evidence seems quite irrefutable. And I do believe that in the future we'll see some proceedings initiated at the International Criminal Court. The reputation of Russia has already been damaged further. But as Quentin pointed out, I'm not sure the Kremlin will lose much sleep over this.
Yeah, on that note, Quentin, you said that Vladimir Putin doesn't care what this investigation comes up with or says, and he may well not. But should he? I mean, how serious is this? Is this potentially, I guess, his Lockerbie moment?
Well, there undoubtedly are going to be a lot of people. This was, a tragic civilian mass killing. And there are a lot of people there, individuals, who will not just lie back and take it. This was not a killing of soldiers. This was not a war killing. This was, a peace killing. So I don't think it'll go away very quickly. But having said that, Mr. Putin is very cynical about the way he conducts his international relations. I think he knows that he is desperately needed by the rest of Europe and by the US for engagement in Syria, that they need a peace deal in Syria. There's this flood of refugees still coming out of that region, and only Russia really can hold it back and restrain Assad in Syria. So I think he says, you know, maybe Ukraine is just yesterday's story. After all, within Russia, Ukraine, certainly the occupation of Crimea, has played very well for Mr. Putin.
Indeed it has. But Oscar, I'm curious to see at least what he makes of this, because he may be, as Quentin was saying, an extremely cynical man, but he's certainly a far from stupid one. He has led the rest of the world on a merry dance on a number of fronts these last couple of years. There is going to be pressure on Russia now to assist in actually, I think, finding out who gave the order, who threw the switch, who actually did this. The investigation says it has the names of 100 people of interest. Is it beyond the realm of imagining that, I guess not dissimilar to the Lockerbie scenario, that Putin might see his way clear to throwing a couple of hapless Ukrainians under the bus in order to make this go away?
I think you're right. As I pointed out, I think we will see proceedings of some sort or another. I know a couple of barristers in this country who are already, looking into it, and we'll see something. And as Quentin pointed out, we'll see developments in relation to Syria. And when that happens, and knowing that Putin, as you suggested, loves playing the midterm, the long-term game, it wouldn't be surprising if we see Russia accepting some responsibility and then clearing, if that clears the way towards some sort of agreement in the Syrian case.
Just to follow that up, though, Oscar, the legal aspects of this are now going to come into, I think, much greater focus. Malaysia Airlines has already settled with the families, as indeed Korean Airlines did after the Soviet Union shot down their flight 007 in 1983. Looking at this with your lawyer's hat on, is there the basis here for potential lawsuits against the government of Russia?
I think there are, in the civil cases, certainly. Although some lawyers think it unlikely that we'll see the ICC intervening in this case, the fact that there were Dutch citizens and British citizens and others might mean, and I think it is likely to mean, that we'll see proceedings begin.
It's a final thought, I guess, on this one, Quentin, or a final-ish thought. This is obviously going to take months, if not years, from now to sort out. Lockerbie, which may be a helpful comparison in some respects, rumbled on and on and on and on for years. But what might a satisfactory resolution look like? And I'm aware, as I say that the word satisfactory in terms of trying to find a way through on a horrible event like this is a poor choice of word. But you know what I mean.
Yes, the trouble is, I don't think you can, actually, in the Lockerbie case, it appeared that at least they could put the finger on a fairly small group of individuals, and therefore throwing somebody into jail maybe sort of answered the case eventually, although even today I think we're uncertain about it. In this case, I think, it looks like a far wider conspiracy here. I mean, they're talking of 100 names that they've got already.
Well, as they say, these are people of interest. These are presumably who might have some idea of who pointed the thing skywards and who pushed the button.
Yes, I think you've got a very hardline group of Russian nationalists on the ground in eastern Ukraine, and you've got their sympathisers in Russia. And I think, actually, at the end of the day, after all, this was a mistake. I think this was intended to be a missile that would, in a high drama thing, bring down a Ukrainian, big Ukrainian military transporter, not bring down a civilian. It's very hard to see how that could have been actually of real interest to the Russians at the time. So I think it was a mistake. Will they sacrifice somebody? I don't think that's in Mr. Putin's inner nature to actually offer a token sacrifice up. So I don't think we're going to see an easy agreement at all.
Okay, well, let's move along now to the death of Shimon Peres at the age of 93. As might have been expected, this has prompted a global outpouring of the sort of thoughtful, reasoned, and nuanced discourse that usually characterizes discussion of the Middle East. Which is to say that any given Martian arriving on Earth today and attempting to familiarize themselves with current events might well be wondering how one man could be both a heroic founding father of a great nation and a revered peacemaker, and yet a merciless marauding warlord. Oscar, first of all, given the extraordinary stature that Peres assumed in the context of Israel and the Middle East, it is vaguely idle, isn't it, to try and decide on an easy one-line definitive assessment of him. I mean, I do remember reading last week somebody made the very good comparison that it is, if you imagine yourself as an American and imagine that Thomas Jefferson is still walking around. He is a person of that stature.
Well, Jefferson was a founding father and also a slave owner. So,
indeed so.
Here we go. Humanity and the human psyche and human politics cannot be understood in binary terms. This is not a black and white situation as none are. In this case, Shimon Peres was a hawk in his young and middle years, instrumental in terms of securing a nuclear capability for Israel. And then in his later years, he became convinced, fiercely convinced, in fact, of the two-state solution. And let us remind ourselves and our readers that he was more loved and popular abroad than within Israel.
He lost
every single...
Five elections.
Exactly. He lost every single election. And only when he was president, which is a sort of symbolic position in Israel, he came to be respected. They saw him as a man who never wore combats and never took a pistol. And what you have there is the contradictions of a politician. I would like to stay with the final Shimon Peres, the one who took that, who thought that peace was possible.
On that subject, Quentin, he was, of course, Nobel Peace Laureate in 1994, sharing it with Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin for the Oslo Accords, which, as we have noticed, failed to deliver a lasting peace to the Middle East. How does posterity view his efforts as a peacemaker, do you think?
I think very contradictory. I think it is this extraordinary figure, this man who appeared to believe in peace and yet presided over periods of real major expansion of the Israeli settlements in Arab areas. As Oscar said, he was instrumental in ensuring that Israel had a nuclear weapon. And indeed, during the 50s, when he was effectively running the defense ministry, he was hugely important in arming Israel and preparing it for the future.
Invasion of Lebanon in 96, I think we chalk up to him as well.
Yes, indeed. Yes. So a very contradictory figure, a fascinating figure. I interviewed him once, a highly intelligent and articulate man. He was extraordinarily well-read and very interesting to talk to. And I think he charmed people like that. But there is this extraordinary dichotomy that actually he was not a successful politician. And he also, if you like, lent his... Dove's clothing to somebody like Sharon, who was a much harder line operator and actually gave a really rather unpleasant Israeli government a sort of cover of respectability. So I find it very difficult to come away from this and saying this man was a peacemaker.
When you spoke to Peres, what sense did you get of that, I guess, trajectory that Oscar described from being the very hawkish securocrat, especially in Israel's early days, you know, the expansionist settlement builder, etc., and then to the man who becomes, I guess, convinced by the idea, or at least the an inevitability, as I think, as he saw it, of a two-state solution.
Well, he was very much into his latter period, if you like, and his passion at the time was this almost border-free Middle East, that you could really have a Middle East-wide peace settlement, and that would work. And he talked very passionately about that, and I think the past, if you like, was buried. And yet... As I say, he neither ever quite convinced the Israeli electorate, nor, I think, did he ever quite convince the outside world. His own ambiguity, his own contradictions are very much the contradictions of the state of Israel.
Perhaps the crucial question is whether there are successors, you know, younger leaders within Israel who would be ready to take the mantle of that later leader, the peacemaker. It seems difficult to think that's the case, and that, of course, would be a major failure on his part.
Yes, I think what we're seeing in Israel is so many years of conflict that have got into the younger generation very much as well, that it is very difficult to see that. But maybe it does need somebody of a different generation to actually put together a long-lasting solution, because somebody like Shimon Peres, who was there at the very start, could never lose that deep conviction that this was an existential challenge.
Oscar, what do we make of the official Palestinian response to his passing? Mahmoud Abbas, I noticed, sent actually quite a sweet letter to his family and made a generous tribute to his efforts as a peacemaker. From Hamas, however, I don't know if they've literally been running out into the streets and firing guns in the air. I wouldn't be altogether surprised, but their statement, his death marks the end of an era in the history of the Israeli occupation, which I guess is not far away from the famous Mark Twain quote to the effect of, I didn't go to the funeral, but sent a nice note saying I approved of it.
Certainly, but you know, in a sense, and this is also part of the contradiction, both sides are correct. It does mark the end of an era, and a very unpleasant era, an era of failed peace attempts and the furthering of the conflict. On the other side, it is the case that, as Abbas seems to suggest, what is needed most at this time is that kind of leadership. Perhaps, as Quentin put it, a newer generation seeking peace.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Quentin Peel, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Coming up next, Colombia prepares to vote on war versus peace, which sounds like a foregone conclusion, but is it?
The well-turned-out, style-themed October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. We tour the globe for the best in the world of retail, with a ranking of the companies and developers doing it best from Sydney to Seoul, past Porto and Poznan. Here's what our sharp-eyed editors have spotted for you this month.
In the affairs section, I head to the Netherlands to find out why Europe's most liberal nation is becoming increasingly right-wing.
The October issue sees the return in the business section of our annual retail survey, where we profile the best new stores, the smartest developers rethinking retail, and the world's great shopping streets.
In culture, we ask a leading question: how do you buy a work of art? To answer it, we have some of the leading lights of contemporary art, from a big league art advisor to an artist himself who says, well, it's your money.
Monocle's October issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
Trump or Clinton? Clinton or Trump? If, like me, you're not American, you don't get a vote. But that doesn't mean we won't be affected. Welcome to the global election.
America is critical to the maintenance of peace and security in the world, not least because of what it stands for as a democratic nation, a guardian of freedom and the values of democratic nations.
From war and peace to the economy and the environment, what happens in America has an impact on us all. A large part of that is influenced by the president, whoever he or she may be. So in the run-up to November's vote, join me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24, as we look at what this election will mean for the rest of the world. That's The Global Election with me, Steve Bloomfield, available for download right now.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Quentin Peel and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, on Monday, Colombia's president and the commander of the indefatigable narco-Marxist militia FARC used a pen fashioned from a bullet to sign a treaty ending more than half a century of war. On Sunday, Colombians will go to the polls to vote in a referendum on how smart an idea this really is. By way of encouragement, FARC's leader, who trades under the nom de guerre of Timochenko, has apologised to the not in considerable quantities of victims of his organisation. Oscar, first of all, this sounds half a century of civil war ending like an entirely good news story, is it?
Oh, well, at least for those of us who have never seen a day of peace in our lifetime, Colombians such as myself, this is indeed historic. It's probably the only one time I will use such a cliché. I'm tired of clichés, by the way. But it is the case that here we're seeing something that most of us never thought possible. And these are the simple facts about this peace process. Number one, an end to war is possible, even in a case of such an intractable conflict as, you know, the Colombian one, which, you know, dragged on for over 60 years. And then the second one, peace takes time. And what matters is what we do with the time, you know, during the time we take. What do we do with that time? And what both parties in this negotiation did during the last 4 years was to sort of renew their own selves from the perspective of their enemy. And it's quite remarkable to see someone who, like Juan Manuel Santos, the president, you know, representative of the old Colombian oligarchy, allowing, welcoming the FARC to democracy, and Rodrigo Londoño, no longer Timochenko, no longer the Netflix narco whatever, asking for forgiveness and accepting responsibility for their crimes. That is really remarkable.
I mean, Quentin, it is, as for all the reasons Oscar has just adumbrated there, an extraordinary story, and it does remind us that wars end. They do all end, however intractable and complicated and ghastly they seem when they're happening, they do finish. The question here, I guess, is, are there lessons from this which are exportable elsewhere, or was this a Colombian process to end a Colombian war?
No, I think it was very much within an international context. Yeah. So feeding in there, you had Obama's opening to Cuba, for example. You have the whole change. If you like, this is the upside of the world that we're seeing a lot of downside to now, that actually the end of the Cold War, all of these things, this is maybe the last really good thing that is going to come out of that. I mean, this is wonderful news. It is actually the best news that we could possibly hear. And a great tribute, I think, to actually also to Obama, the peacemaker, that he too has created an environment where it was possible to do this. But once it's going to take, as Oscar said, a very long time for people to get used to the peace. That's a very difficult process for people who've known nothing but conflict in their lives, who've actually got these totally different narratives about the good and the bad guys. And that was, I think, the problem in our earlier discussion of Israel. Here are people who've been locked into a conflict for so long, they can no longer see the other side. Okay, we've suddenly got a break point, and it would be stunning if it works. And I think it would be an example for everybody.
I think that's a condition of human society and individual humans as well. There is a tendency to believe that the present is the future, that nothing will ever change, that people never think the good times will end, and they never think the bad times will end either. Both have a habit of doing that one way or the other. Oscar, Colombia goes to the polls this weekend. I guess the obvious question is there any reason to doubt the result? But the question to follow that up is, the people who vote against this agreement, why are they against it?
I think that's an important question. They are against it for many reasons, but mostly, as Quentin suggested, because memories of the past do not enable them to abandon the war in their hearts. That's the difficulty.
They want to see members of FARC going to jail.
Absolutely.
Don't they?
I mean, many. Let me tell you one story. A friend of mine whose father was shot by FARC when they were, taking over his summer house. She has seen the war, as many urban Colombians, mostly on the TV screens, but was affected at that, that fleeting moment directly. And that seems for her to have become an indelible moment. So of course, the next challenge is, how are we going to allow people such as her to exchange that pain, that trauma, that position with the traumas and the positions sense of, say, grassroots communities in rural areas who were obliterated by the paramilitary. That's going to be the challenge, but I think that's precisely the challenge that Colombians are ready to take, and that's why this process is exportable. In fact, you can see already in Spain, for instance, sectors of the Basque population asking for something like that in the case of Spain. And that's quite remarkable and quite interesting.
Well, just finally and very briefly, the result for the referendum on Sunday, are you confident?
I'm confident. I think it's going to be a yes. And I have to be confident because I want my daughters to be able to go back to a country that will welcome them.
Okay, well, finally tonight, on that hopeful note, we shall stick with the subject of referenda or referendums. As many people in this country, 48% of them to be precise, might warn Colombians, one cannot be complacent about the results, even when the question seems scarcely more nuanced than would you like a massive pain in the neck or not? Such populism appears to be becoming more popular, but is Vox Populi really Vox Dei, or are the general public an ignorant rabble whose incoherent prejudices should only be applied to legislation after being properly mediated by their elected representatives? Quentin, are referendum a way for politicians to actually respect the people's will or merely abnegate their own responsibilities?
I think very much the latter. I hate this exercise as a pretense of democracy that masquerades as real democracy, because it reduces these very difficult questions to just black and white, yes or no. And even then, the actual result very seldom answers the question on the paper. So take the British referendum on Europe. The question on the paper, should Britain remain a member of the European Union or not? And the answer was given is, we want to stop immigration. This has been the same. I've covered many referendums throughout Europe, in Denmark, in the Netherlands, in France, and in Ireland, and in Sweden. And they've usually been just, we're fed up with the government, so let's say the opposite to what the government wants. And then when they realise that actually that is producing a nightmare of a result, people try and wriggle out of it in some way. We've got parliamentary democracy, and that's the way we should decide these things. And I totally agree with Clement Attlee, quoted by Margaret Thatcher, who said referendums are a trick of populists and dictators.
Well, in fact, any historian of Roman law would make a distinction between plebiscites, you know, initiatives made by the people themselves, and referenda, who are always entail a forced choice.
There's also, I think this is what makes them more poisonous, and we certainly saw that this summer in the UK, Quentin. It's the zero-sum nature of them. In a normal election, if your lot gets beaten, well, fine, you can come back and have another crack in 4 or 5 years. But a referendum, that's it, you've lost.
Yeah, it seems to be absolutely final and on a very narrow margin. And so everybody says, you know, UK referendum, this was an overwhelming result. It was not. It was a very narrow result. But the 48% who didn't want this result are now completely ignored as if they're totally powerless.
I mean, Oscar, is there an argument for them, though, I guess, in a case like Colombia's, which if it is voted through, it will be upheld as a feel-good referendum story. Ireland's vote on gay marriage was widely perceived as that, although interestingly in Australia, which to my enduring shame still hasn't got with the programme on this, there is now a row over whether a referendum is an appropriate way to do it, and a lot of the people who want gay marriage enacted don't want it done by referendum because they don't think that a special case should be made for them, because it makes it look like it is some sort of concession being granted to them rather than a right being acknowledged, etc. Does it depend on the issue? Are some subjects suited to referendums?
You know, going back to that distinction I just made before, you know, if you take the Colombian referendum, it is different insofar as behind that there is a history of plebiscites, you know, in popular initiatives for peace going back to the 1990s, to the early 90s. That's very different from asking people about Brexit, which was a sort of, you know, exactly black and white solution. So the one argument I would give is this one. After we have, you know, Brexit 2 referendum, I want want a referendum to abolish all referenda.
I would agree with that. Also one on abolishing umbrellas, but that's just a personal prejudice of mine. Just putting it out there, planting seeds. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Oscar Guardiola-Rivera and Quentin Peel, thank you both very much. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Beatrice Carmi. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Music next, 1900, Daniel's in with the entrepreneurs, and there's more on the main stories with Emma Nelson, I think I'm right in saying, on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'll be your host for that as well. But for now, from me, Andrew Muller, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.